I've decided I dislike both my face and my voice, and it's sort of, I'm too old to change either one, I guess. I guess I could change my voice a little bit. I could go to school.
You could change your face.
We're all too old to change.
I could change my face.
How'd the interview on the CBS Morning News go?
Well, Diane Sawyer was very lively and pretty, and I was fairly stupid, I thought. But game, you know, I was in there punching, even though I kept missing.
What'd she ask you?
Oh, she asked me awkward questions like, why are witches women? You think it'd be a question I'd have a set answer for, but I didn't really. And then she asked me, what do women want out of men? Which is a question so cosmic and searching that I could hardly think of anything at all. I decided finally couldn't imagine what they wanted out of men. Whatever they wanted, they weren't likely to get it.
She should have asked that one of Dan Greenberg. I think he wrote a book of that title.
Oh, he did?
You should have told her also that men can be witches.
If they can.
Did you tell her that?
No, I didn't. I don't want to argue. We have a little time. But it is true.
I'm fascinated.
Some of the best witches have been men, and some of the more enthusiastic modern witches.
I am sorry, you're supposed to be good. I'm often fascinated about the things that TV people ask authors. I had an author in by the name of A.E. Hotchner a while back. Hotchner wrote a biography of Hemingway called Papa
yes,
Hemingway.
And another book.
Friend of Hemingway's for 14 years. He also had a very interesting battle with Random House, which was over Random House's rejection of a novel he wrote called, I think it was called King of the Hill, or Top of the Hill, I can't remember. I think Urban Shaw wrote a novel with a similar title. And Random House rejected it, but he refused to give back the advance, which was $11,500, and so Random House sued, and they had an out-of-court settlement. He served as his own lawyer. Well, I asked questions about how he started in the literary business. He worked for Cosmopolitan as a literary bounty hunter. He chased down authors who had not been performing for some time, like Lillian Hellman, Edna Ferber, and people like mm-hmm. that. And so we focused on these literary angles. Well, about two or three days later, I happened to see him. I believe it was on Merv Griffin's show. And the interview was entirely different from mine. What they had done with him, they had blown up slides of people like Clark Gable, Sophia Loren. He had written a biography of Sophia Loren, Candy Bergen, and people like that. And so the interview, which mine had a literary thrust, became a showbiz interview by the time it reached syndicated television. And I was just, so I'm always amused by it. I shouldn't be, but I am.
Hotchner, as you know, also wrote Doris Day, her own story with Doris Day.
That's right.
So he is, can be approached from a number of angles.
Did you ever read E.M. Forster's short story, which was called The Hour After Westerly?
Is it E.M. Forster's or Robert Coates's?
The wonderful short story about a man driving through Rhode Island and he loses an hour. A complete hour has gone out of his life, and he tries to reconstruct it. He looks at his watch, and he tries to... I've read this many, many years ago, and it's probably anthologized somewhere, but because you set the witches of Eastwick in Rhode Island and make reference to Westerly and so forth, I was thinking of that marvelous story that he had written in the 1940s, and I wondered if...
I did read that story a long time ago. It did not occur to me. What did occur to me is that there have been very few books that I know of set in Rhode Island. And I wanted to set this book out of Massachusetts, where I live, and went down to Rhode Island, looked around, and tried to get a little local color. And it's a curious state. It is the smallest state, but as I say in the book, it has its own character. That is, when you're in Rhode Island, you couldn't be anyplace else. And it was sort of fun to explore the state a little and to try to put its quality down in a few pages of print.
Does Rhode Island indeed have a history of witchcraft?
Not much, I don't think. The witchcraft was mostly in Massachusetts, as far as I know. As you probably know, in the 17th century, the witches were thought to be everywhere, pretty much. So I'm sure there was some muttering in Rhode Island too, but. Rhode Island's claim to fame, basically, is that being a sort of no man's land between Connecticut and Massachusetts. They took in all of the rejects of the two straightforward colonies, and so Roger Williams went there, and Anne Hutchison, the number of other Quakers and Jews also could settle in Rhode Island when they couldn't settle anywhere else. So it's sort of appealing that way.
It is. Although, when you think about it, Rhode Island doesn't have much reason for existing. I mean, it's kind of like a city-state sprawled around Providence, isn't it?
Exactly. And both Connecticut and Massachusetts wanted it. And there are many petitions to the king to let them have Rhode Island, and Rhode Island fought to be its own self. And won, as you can see.
I also want to ask you a couple of questions, if you don't mind, about the craft of writing, because it's one of the thrust that I make in this little broadcast of mine. Where did you start your research into witches? How?
Well, in a way, the research began with my being a boy, because I grew up in a kind of witchy part of the country. My grandmother was a Pennsylvania Dutch woman who was full of superstitions, and the whole area, in fact, is fairly saturated, at least it was in the 30s and 40s, with the possibility that a evil spirit might grab you around the corner. At college, I read one book about witchcraft, which impressed me greatly, Michelet's, in English it's called Satanism and Witchcraft in the Middle Ages, and it presents the theory that the witch was a perpetuator of the pagan religion, a subversive element in Christendom, and that she was therefore persecuted for being just this. When I settled in to finally write the book, which had been in my mind for a number of years, the first place I turned was Margaret Murray's two books on witchcraft, which kind of began the modern approach to witchcraft in the 1920s and 30s, and I must have read about 20 books, all of which after a while began to say the same thing. What emerged for me that I hadn't quite known is that there's no absolute proof that there were ever any women who really did think of themselves as witches, that there were some women, a number of women confessed to witchcraft, but it was either it was under torture or they might have been crazy. So that the entire notion of a coven that met in orderly fashion and worshipped the devil and performed these rites and danced and all the things that witches allegedly do may be entirely in the imaginations of the male Christian persecutors of these poor women. But anyway, I'm rather more attracted to the view that there was a kind of diabolism as a way out of the Christian consensus and the oppressive Christian consensus. I don't see why there wouldn't have been in the 1700s, since there certainly has been in the 1900s, and today you can pick up, you know, witch magazines, read interviews with witches all the time. It's quite a common theme, indeed, in
time. You certainly have endowed your three witches in the Witches of Eastwood with a high degree of sexuality. How did that come about?
Well, I think, A, people are sexual, more or less, and two, these so-called obscene rites were always part of the alleged description, or the description of the alleged events that happens at Coven. There was a great deal of dancing and kissing of the devil's derriere, and then a kind of collapse at the end into a incestuous, heterosexual, homosexual kind of seethe, so that my own milder events have good authority in the annals of witchcraft.
Well, the Witches of Eastwick certainly has caught on. I understand it's on the bestseller list already.
It's done surprisingly well. I tend not to write real bestsellers. I think of Robert Ludlum or Stephen King as writing real bestsellers. But yeah, I think it'll do all right, and I hope my publisher unloads most of the copies that he's printed. Well, yeah, you know, it's something that does interest us to a degree, witchcraft, and also the book is about women, about the new woman, about what women do once they shed themselves of patriarchal notions, and it's furthermore meant to be somewhat, although not only, funny, so that all these things perhaps give it some appeal to the mass.
I'm not going to ask you what women want from men. Rabbit is Rich. You won the Pulitzer Prize for that, didn't you?
To my surprise and delight, I did, yes.
Yeah. That also became a bestseller. I think that Harry Engstrom will live in American literary history for many, many years to come.
He's been kind to me, and I have found it up to now quite easy to write about him. As I've often said, I didn't really mean to write a sequel when I wrote Rabbit Run in 1959, but 10 years later, a sequel suggested itself, and I jumped into it blindly. There's a great deal of blind jumping in any author's life, and it sort of wrote itself, and many people liked it, not all, but many, and I kind of liked it. I at least liked being with him and being back in Pennsylvania. And then, of course, one sequel demands another, and Rabbit is Rich surprised me by being quite well received both by the critics and by the public and by finally the prize committees. So I think I did very well with that. I've promised that I must will write one more. I don't have to do it now, but I should by the end of the decade, and it somewhat worries me that I might make a botch of the whole tetralogy by writing a bad novel. But one walks by faith and one writes by faith, and somehow Harry is interesting enough to me and enough like me without being me that I've always found it kind of easy to write about him once I get started.
You say you're worried about writing a bad novel?
I feel that Rabbit is Rich especially did come off pretty well. I mean, it's not easy for an author to judge his own books, but it felt alive as I was doing it, and it kind of made me laugh, and characters who had been minor developed into major characters in the book, and Harry in middle age. He's so unlike what we might expect if we only read Rabbit Run, you know. It's sort of fun, that surprisingness that life holds for all of us and for Harry Engstrom as well. So, at any rate, I would like to somehow round it out and cap it off, which means I have to decide what the real deep themes of this series are, and somehow write a book that in some way winds up those themes or puts a lid on them. I'm not describing it terribly well, but no, I think it'll be hard for me, at least in the beginning, to get started for fear that I'll make a botch of the entire series by writing this last book not well.
So you would be frightened that the entire series would be jeopardized by one book that you might consider not up to the standard.
If I consider it really not up, of course I won't publish it, I'll try again.
Yeah.
But that it might not be up to the standard and I wouldn't know it. It's possible that I said everything about him. One thing that worries me slightly is that in Rabbit is Rich, he's a year younger than I am, so he would have been somewhere around 46. So that makes him 56, which by no means is the end of a man's life, is it? I mean, unless he's unlucky, 56 is somewhere near the far edge of the prime. So how can I end the series when the man's only 56? Clearly, he's not going to die unless he captures something terrible, huh? Maybe he was exposed to Agent Orange, or I don't know. But no, I think he will have to. I will have to somehow end the series without ending Harry. But that's all right. I think I've been talking too much about it for fear I'm going to give the whole book away. But I have very few ideas in my mind now about what's going to happen to him.
You said that you were glad to put your character back in Pennsylvania, and a moment ago you also said you were glad to leave Massachusetts, where you are living. But you're not a stranger to new locales. The coup, for example, where you had the African colonel. You must have spent some time in Africa to do some research there.
A little time. Perhaps a total of, if you count Egypt and Morocco as part of Africa, I may have spent about a total of 6 weeks on the continent. And I had read a lot of African novels, and I was trying to write one more African novel. Most of my research was done in books. I'd never been to that specific part of Africa. It is the Sahel, sort of sub-Saharan dry countries like Mali, Chad, and Niger that my fictional Kush is more or less based on. But no, you're right. I do try to vary my locales somewhat. I guess all authors do if they write enough books. And my first novels tended to be about Pennsylvania, where I grew up. And I've lived in New England ever since. And, of course, I've located some books in New England. But our world is getting smaller. Jet flight and TV and everything makes these other lands realer and realer to us. And I think it's possible for a novelist with a little gumption to locate a book almost anywhere. I remember People magazine, not the ultimate critical authority, but a formidable presence on the newsstand, said that Dickens didn't write about Arizona and Updike shouldn't be writing about Africa. I thought that was a rather doctrinaire point of view, and I think had Dickens known as much about Arizona as one can now know about Africa, I would not deny him the pleasure of locating a book in it. No, I think we must use our imaginations. Our lives possibly are becoming increasingly sedentary and chair-bound, so in compensation, I think we should try to imagine the world as a whole and visit parts of it.
Well, it's interesting that this popular magazine would attempt to establish boundaries for writers. You're a versatile writer enough to collect your essays and criticism. As I recall, your last book, I can't remember the title, I should, but I've forgotten it, but it won the National Book Critics Circle Award earlier this year.
The book was called Hugging the Shore.
That's right.
A rather forgettable title, but the best I could think of. I called it that because I had a photograph of me sitting in a rowboat that seemed rather funny to me, and so having a yen to put that on the jacket, I thought I should think of a title to go with it. But I'm of two minds about myself as a critic. I began it around 1960. I began to write the occasional book review for the New Yorker, and then as the older critics died off or wandered away, I found myself writing more and more of them. And with considerable pleasure and self-edification, one does it basically, instead of going to school, you now are a book reviewer, which forces you to read books you might otherwise not seek out, and to try to think of what you think of them and write. I don't know, it's been good for me up to a point, but I would hate to have it take over from my dreaming capacity, so I write more book reviews than I do short stories or poems. I began as a poet and still would like to be a poet, and with the book reviews, there's always a market for them, and people enjoy book reviews, don't we? I mean, I enjoy other people's. We all find it easier to read a review than read a book. It takes much less time, and in a way, kind of delivers the goods to us in these five-minute parcels that our lives are made up of. But I still think my calling should be to write books rather than book reviews.
Well, your first book of poetry was The Carpentered Hen in 1958, and you've had a number of books of poetry since. And there was Midpoint, and there was Telephone Poles. When are we going to get some more poetry? I enjoy it. They're light and poems, and I like them a lot. And I haven't seen any for a while.
Well, thank you. As it turns out, my next book, God willing, is a book called Facing Nature, which is a collection of poems. And I amused myself this spring while waiting for the novel to come out by collecting them and writing some new ones. I try to make every 6 or 7 years, just kind of a roundup. And although I've not written poems with the steadiness that I once brought to it, you know, I began as a light verse writer when there was still a market for light verse. And the New Yorker was happy to have it. Other magazines, now vanished, were happy to have light verse. And so it was kind of a trade, in a way, something you could do with self-respect. And but by the time I was 30, the market had faded. Maybe my light verse wasn't good enough, but one thing or another, I sort of dropped it. And most of the poems in the new book are what I would call serious, but perhaps there's something light about them. There's about 6 light poems and about 50 that are meant to be more or less serious. But after all, what is serious and what is light? There's a certain lightness in the very attempt to make pictures out of words, isn't there? As soon as you pick up a pen, somehow it becomes a kind of light thing. So that, say, The Witches of Eastwick is in many ways a comical novel, though meant kind of, it was for me, it was unpacking a certain burden of information and feeling, but in the rendering, somehow things become lighter, and poetry is one way in which we lighten the world for ourselves.
Did you at one time intend to make a career in art? I know that you had studied in Oxford.
My first love as a child was of cartoons, and I used to sit at about the age of 5 and copy, you know, comic strips. And then I fell in love with Walt Disney. I've been to all of the Walt Disney feature-length cartoons more than once, and I imagined that I would, maybe if I was lucky, work in the Disney studios. But by the time I was a grown person, the Disney studios had much changed. The world changes. You know, you aim, it's like shooting at a moving target, isn't it? You aim for a certain kind of success, and when the time you arrived, you find that field no longer exists. And also, I didn't really have it as a cartoonist, possibly. I never could think of enough ideas. But until I was about 22, I still had some hopes that I might become an artist of some kind. I loved to draw. This conjuring up of things with ink on white paper is quite magical, a little more magical perhaps than doing it with words, but words turned out to be what I could make a living with, and I believe words are sufficiently elastic so that some of the cartooning talent or ambition has gotten into the writing.
Does the mature John Updike have a degree of nostalgia for the days as a staff writer on The New Yorker?
Well, if I'd been really nostalgic, I wouldn't have left, and I might even be there yet. But although I enjoyed those 2 years, and they really, it was fun to be in New York City, where I'd always wanted to live, like many an American boy. I'd grown up with images of New York and penthouses, the good life in New York, so it was nice to come here and try it out. See that it wasn't at all like the movie said.
Try living next to a firehouse. Like I do.
Yes, there seem to be a lot of fires in New York. I'm always struck by that when I come down, how those sirens are going and going. New York really is like a constant disaster that never quite collapses. I don't know how it keeps going. And it is a very wonderful, wonderful place. But to live here didn't seem to me helpful at a certain point, and so I took my family and my hopes and went north with them. Not exactly planning to stay forever, but I wanted to. There were some novels I wanted to write, and I thought I could live cheaper out of the city and maybe have a little more psychic space to explore my own treasures rather than. In New York, people are always offering you ideas about what to do with your time. I find there's a lot of a cooperative effort in New York artistic circles, which I, for the moment, wanted to get away from. So, to make a long story short, I did quit the job at The New Yorker and set up shop as a freelancer in New England, and never had to come back, and so there I've stayed. It's a little surprising to me. Here I am, 52. I still feel like a tourist in New England, in a way, although it seems to have been my home now for 30 years. And I think I've been both lucky and unlucky, like everybody else. I've been lucky in that I did find what I went for. I found the space. I've been able to write my own books. I have no complaints about the circumstances in which I've had to produce books. They've been ideal. I've also lost out, though, on whatever edge it is that people who live in New York have. I think they are smarter than the rest of us, or at least quicker on their feet. And at times I wonder if I ought to try to come back.
Well, in fact, Kurt Vonnegut was here to tell me that he left Cape Cod for the very reason that perhaps you are there. He felt that he missed the excitement and the drama and the conflict that you find in the city, and that it was more difficult for him to work in the more quiet rural atmosphere.
Yes, and where I live isn't so unlike the Cape, although it's a different end of Greater Boston. When you're down here, you certainly aren't aware of the multitudes on the street. I mean, 1,000 stories go by every minute if you're open to it, and just what people wear. I didn't realize, for example, living in the boondocks as I do, that people are all wearing painter outfits now, that all of the lovely girls are clad in what you used to see only the guy who came to paint your shutters in. So this and things like this are certainly worth knowing.
Do they have driblets of paint on the clothes?
No, they're shiny white, but it's a strange image. Not just females, but young men who wish to present themselves in an interesting manner seem now to be wearing these painter outfits. The pants are kind of tucked in and so on. But anyway, I didn't know what people were wearing until I came down here most recently.
Well, John, I'm glad we're almost out of time. I've got to get you going, and I've got to get back to my, unfortunately, my real job. But I did want to ask you one question about, I mentioned before, the craft of writing. When you wrote The Witches of Eastwick, and indeed when you wrote Rabbit is Rich and the others, do you find yourself writing in a burst of constant energy, or is this something that is done in a casual way, or how does it work for you?
Well, since I don't do anything else, I go to my office, which is in a wing of my house, after breakfast, like most men go to work, and I try to remember that other men all around me are working away, drilling teeth and drilling streets and delivering mail and whatnot, so who am I not to be working? And the inspiration, such as it is, usually has to be kind of worked up. I've found that there's a kind of an hour, a dull hour, when you are trying to get back into it, an hour when you're really into it and the things seem to be happening by themselves, and then maybe an hour when you're winding down. And this should produce 3 or 4 pages. And in that way, I wrote through Rabbit is Rich and The Witches of Eastwick and all the other books. The moment of excitement really comes before you actually sit down at all at the desk. It's when you get the idea and you feel it inside you as something wanting to be born, wanting to be said. And then you see the book more or less whole, with some gaps, of course. But then you are inspired, if ever, and feel excited about it, and the rest is work of a kind.
Do you write the book as a whole and revise? Do you revise as you go along, or how does it work for you?
A bit of both, but in general I think it's better to make forward progress and then see the thing as a whole before you really begin to revise. And I'm not one of the world's great revisers. I mean, I tend to change the sentences around in the words, but not the general paragraphs or the characters. I don't delete characters or change. But even when it feels kind of sludgy, I think it's better to keep going than to try to make it perfect before you go on. Because what is perfect in art, after all? What looks perfect one day looks kind of dull the next, and vice versa. Sometimes the things you do on what feel like dull gray days turn out to be the ones that have most life on the page. It's a mysterious business.
Is there a degree of frustration in writing? Dashiell Hammett complained that he had writer's block, and there are people who say there is no such thing as writer's block.
I don't know what happened to Hammett or to some others who've stopped writing after promising careers. It might be that Hammett, who had written a great deal in a hurry, was kind of used up. What I think writer's block usually is you've actually lost faith in yourself or in the art of writing, or both. In other words, it no longer seems worthwhile to produce a book. And I think as long as it seems worthwhile to you, as long as you get excited about the idea of there being someday an artifact that says John Updike or whatever on it, that as long as you are excited by that, you will get around your balked moments and can continue to write. That it's really a way of the body saying, no, I just don't believe in writing anymore, when you have these alleged blocks.
When you were a very young man and you saw the first copy of The Poor House Fair come off the press or reach your house or wherever you were at that time, what was the feeling like?
Amazement that I'd produced this. It didn't seem to have any real relation to me. I forget how I first saw The Poor House Fair. I remember that I first saw Rabbit Run on a table in somebody else's apartment in New York City. I was down and hadn't known the book was out. And there the finished book was, and a sense of total wonder. I knew that this was my book in my head, but in my heart I had no way of relating this lovely, shiny package to me.
Have you ever done any teaching of writing?
I taught the summer school of Harvard at Harvard in 1962, and although it wasn't an unpleasant experience, I found it basically, I couldn't see the kids' things were any worse than mine. And it was sort of like looking down when you're on a tightrope. It made me dizzy, And also it takes energy, of course, and you lose your innocence, or I found I was losing mine, so I've not gone back to teaching.
Well, my last question to you, John Updike, and you can sidestep this one if you wish, because it's kind of an ambiguous question, but since you have done some teaching and you are obviously a man of great skill and craftsmanship, would you care to share any advice or give any advice to young people who might aspire to be a writer in say, your mold?
Well, to go back to what I said, I think you have to begin with a certain blind and innocent faith that you do have something to say, and that if you have this faith, I think the world will bend over backwards to let you say it. I think that most of the people who are failed writers are ones who didn't push ahead with quite enough single-mindedness. They allowed themselves to be deflected. So have the faith. Secondly, try to read. See what's been done in the language so you don't repeat what has already been done as well as it ever can be done. Three, don't begin the project until you have some sense of how it's going to end. I think there's too much writing done sort of impulsively, and we do need, when we put a story or a novel down, a sense that the author knew what he was doing. That, after all, is what distinguishes art from the real world. We're not sure that the real world knows what it's doing, but we do hope to, in a book, to be put in the hands of somebody who's going to guide us along a certain path. So those three major items are about all I could say to the young aspiring writer now.
John Updike, it was short notice, but I'm delighted that you came in, and I thank you very, very much.
Thank you.